Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next 30 minutes. On today's show, Nature's Best, we'll go to Cortis Island, BC, where we talk with marine biologist Misty McDuffie. She says the number of southern orca whales has been in constant decline over the past 20 years.
There's a fundamental shift that has to occur in how we're showing up on the planet, both in terms of our economic models and our consumption and our choices, and then right down to the choices that we're making just living within a watershed on a daily and weekly basis.
In Oshawa, Ontario, a rare variety of albino hummingbirds has been observed recently, a rare phenomenon.
I did a little bit of research on albino hummingbirds. There's only been about 150 recognized in all of North America. So the fact that we found multiple on Six Nations is a really big deal, and it's very interesting that, you know, they're able to survive in this area as opposed to somewhere else where they're not found at all.
A group of water advocates are headed to Lake Titicaca in Peru to participate in an international conference and talk about how climate change has affected their communities.
We're at this stage now where we need to start thinking about how we respond to climate change in this region and how our communities are going to adapt and continue to thrive in the future.
And we'll leave the air, waters, and forests to take to the ice as Hockey Nova Scotia is campaigning to shelter their referees from verbal and physical abuse. Welcome to Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
So as Montreal is hosting until December 19, the 15th United Nations Conference on Biodiversity, some water advocates from the West Kootenay region of British Columbia are headed to Peru to present their work and insights at an international climate conference from December 5th to 9. Representatives from Living Lakes Canada, an NGO based in Nelson, BC, that aims to protect Canada's lakes, rivers, wetlands, and watersheds, met with its international counterparts at the 16th conference of the Living Lakes Network in the city of Puno, Peru, on the shores of Lake Titicaca. They were there to talk about how climate change has affected their communities and to share positive examples and strategies. The group has recently completed upgrades to its water monitoring in the Kootenays, thanks to automated sensors placed in various watersheds. The sensors measure values like water flow and quality and provide a better view of how climate change is impacting the area. We are looking at how much water is flowing down the stream at a given time, and that is impacted by things like precipitation, snowpack, and glacial melt, says climate observer Paige Thurston and Living Lakes program manager. More on this with John Roon in Nelson, British Columbia.
It is the 16th time that Living Lakes holds its annual conference for the International Network, but it's the first time Paige Thurston visits. She will be representing the Nelson-based Canadian affiliate of the network, who is heading to Peru to trade experiences on how climate change has affected their communities.
I'm very interested to learn about how other countries are addressing climate change, how they're adapting, and just hear some of those different perspectives on climate change and those impacts to our water systems.
For Thurston, there isn't much of a risk of running out of things to talk about from the home front. In the Kootenays, the group has identified over 4.5 kilometers of shoreline around Kootenay Lake lost to development. And just a week ago, experts told the Nelson Star that the Kokanee Glacier is on its last 50 years of existence. And more insights are on the way. Recently, Living Lakes Canada completed an upgrade of its water monitoring operations in the region, installing automated sensors and watersheds in several rural parts of the region to get a more complete picture over the next 10 years.
Here in the West Kootenay, that work covered the north end of Kootenay Lake, the Slocan Valley, and the Arrow Lakes Valley. In the East Kootenay, we worked in the Columbia Valley as well as the Elk River Valley. And in each of those areas, we are implementing a coordinated water monitoring network to better understand how climate change is impacting water and hydrology in the area. And the goal is to expand that program across the Columbia Basin over the next several years. We want to build a better picture of what's happening in those areas and how they're changing with climate change. You know, the quantity of water flowing down our streams, the timing of that flow, as well as water quality. So we're looking at how much water is flowing down a stream at a given time, and that's impacted by things like precipitation, snowpack, and also glacial melt.
The conference will be held in Puno, Peru, at the shores of Lake Titicaca, the second largest freshwater lake in South America, and home to a highly sensitive glacial ecosystem. ecosystem, which in recent years has attracted increasing attention from environmentalists who say the impact seen there are early warning signs of what's to come.
I think there's definitely reason for concern here. You know, science has been telling us for decades that there's a need for more climate action and that we need to do more. You know, we're at this stage now where we need to start thinking about how we respond to climate change in this region and how our communities are going to adapt and continue to thrive in the future.
Reporting in Nelson, John Roon.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
Southern resident orca populations off Cortes Island, BC, remain critically endangered, according to marine biologist Misty McDuffie. Cortes Island, off the BC coast, located in the Salish Sea, is considered to be part of the Discovery Island and the North Gulf Island archipelago. Locals and tourists in the area do enjoy consistent sightings of whales in the region, but a marine biologist says resident orcas are still endangered despite recent high visibility. Misty McDuffie, Wild Salmon Program Director for Raincoast Conservation Foundation, specializes in Chinook salmon habitat research, which led her to focus on predators like orca whales. McDuffie says the orca population, despite the numerous sightings in the Salish Sea, are not getting enough food and that the waters are too noisy and sometimes contaminated. But she also underlines that the northern orca is benefiting from less human-developed regions and privileged access to salmon migrating from the north. The marine biologist focuses on collecting research to help inform policymakers so that they can make better decisions. Lonely Taylor spoke with biologist Misty McDuffie.
Most of my focus is on salmon, and it was really working in the watersheds on the BC coast and through the Great Bear Rainforest that I developed this awareness of what a profound influence salmon really have on our coastal ecosystems. And that has really led into the work that I do now, which is as primarily on fisheries and trying to make fisheries so that they are sustainable and that they consider different ecosystems in their management. And that goal still eludes us here in British Columbia. It's still all about the humans. As in most parts of the world, fisheries are really managing their sort of sustainability from an economic perspective, in our ability to meet the needs of humans and other predators that also depend on these fish, and the ecosystems often get left out of the equation. So much of my time is spent on the predators and the ecosystems that also require salmon.
In layman's terms for the listeners, what is it that you do?
So I look at a lot at fishing plans, annual fishing plans. I look at where those fisheries are conducted. I look at how many fish get to spawn, how many make it through the hooks and the nets and actually get back to the rivers. And then I also look at how much does the wildlife need, whether that's grizzly bears or killer whales. Are we leaving enough salmon so that the wildlife that depend on them get enough to eat? And that really comes down to how many fish get caught and how many get to spawn. We try to use that information to inform better decision making. That's really what we're all about. We're advocates, but we say we're informed advocates because we are conducting research and trying to apply it so that humans can make better decisions about how we manage ecosystems and wildlife. And I would always go back, as soon as I say those words, I would go back and say, actually, the ecosystems and the wildlife don't need any managing. It's the humans that need the managing. So in collecting this information, that it'll inform our ability to make better decisions.
Are politicians and policymakers consulting the Raincoast?
It depends. Often we want their attention more so. Sometimes they do come to us, especially when issues get a lot of profile and governments or decision makers are unsure how to go on certain things, or they want to better understand the science of a situation. And across the board at Raincoast, we've got some pretty phenomenal experts on our team. And sometimes government comes to us and says, how do we better understand this? How do we conduct a study to better understand this? Or what kind of information should we be considering in making decisions? So it goes both ways. Sometimes we're knocking at their door and saying, hey, you're not paying any attention to this, and this could help us all live with a lighter footprint. And other times they seek us out.
You spoke about the predators that you focus on, salmon predators. We here on Cortez Island, we see quite a lot of salmon predator activity. I'm really interested to hear what the health status is of whales in the region, just because there's people say things like their populations are snapping back and this or that. So I'm just really curious what's actually going on from a marine biologist's perspective.
The type of whales that consume the most salmon are our resident killer whales. And so we've got three different what we call ecotypes of killer whales in coastal BC. That we've got the salmon eaters that are called the residents. We've got the marine mammal eaters that are called the bigs or the transient killer whales. And then we've got another group of killer whales that's more offshore. And we don't know as much about them, but the scientists that study them think they largely eat sharks. So three different ecotypes. One ecotype eats salmon. And then in BC, there's two broad populations of those resident killer whales. There's the northern residents and the southern residents. The northern residents are doing not too badly. Their populations are growing. Their numbers are up. They've got more pods within their population, and they're doing much better. The southern residents, on the other hand, are critically endangered, and their numbers are only declining since they were listed about 20 years ago now. And in southern British Columbia, we have very congested waters with vessel traffic. We have the fish populations down here. The salmon populations tend to not be as robust as the ones that are being accessed by the northern residents, also because they're migrating. Northern residents have access to them before the southern residents. And the waters down here are contaminated. So these three things, not enough food, too noisy of a living environment that prevents the whales from successfully catching their prey, and the contamination within that prey, have all conspired to meet a declining population that is critically endangered. It's very interesting. And that border between those two populations, what sort of divides the Salish Sea from the central and north coasts, is right around Cortez Island, right where you are, that dividing line. You probably even see it, like the southern parts of Cortez swing with the Salish Sea, right? Like the weather is influenced by the Salish Sea, and Salish Sea is having a good day, a beautiful day. So it's the southern part of Cortez, but the northern part probably swings more with Johnson Strait and the north. So the range of the southern residents is as far as Cortez. And then on the other side of your island, you're getting the tail end of the range of the northern residents. Those are the salmon eaters, and two very different states of populations based on vessel traffic, the amount of salmon they have access to, and the contaminants that are in those salmon.
Wow, that's all very interesting. How you describe the salmon is coming from the north and the northern region is getting access to that first, as if there's nothing coming from the south.
So I'm talking about their migration routes, but in terms of the health of salmon populations as well. So if we look at the range of this population right on the border, because they're at what we call a transboundary population. So they're shared whales. The U.S. has responsibility for them as well, and they're listed as endangered in the U.S. as well. So if you look at the range of all the resident killer whales, it overlaps on North America with the range of Chinook salmon. And the further south you go, the worse it seems that Chinook salmon are doing. When these salmon go to sea, they leave their watersheds from San Francisco all the way up to Alaska. So the tiny little fish leave their watersheds and they migrate north to the Gulf of Alaska. And they spend time in the North Pacific, generally around the Gulf of Alaska, and then they migrate back home. And they do that along the shelf. So they migrate north along the shelf when they're tiny little fish as juveniles. And when they come back, they migrate south down the shelf as adults. So that's how they move and they intertwine with the North Pacific, and why on their migration route south, the northern residents have access to them before the southern residents.
what is it that humans need to do? How do they need to be managed in order to allow nature to replenish and heal and recuperate these populations of orca whales?
Yeah, and the salmon as well, right? It's our footprint across ecosystems, across different species. It's all intertwined. If we start with saying the most basic thing that these whales need is adequate food supply, then how do we manage salmon differently? The more that we conduct activity in those drainages where the rivers are, the more we change the flow of water, the quality of water, the amount of water. So we get floods and droughts, the more that we pave, the more that we sprawl, the more we clear cut, the more mining activities, or at least open pit mining activities, all of these things all affect how water moves through a watershed, which affects the salmon that try to spawn in that watershed and the survival of those salmon. So if we can't give these salmon healthy rivers with clean water that isn't a drought in the summer and isn't a flood in the winter, that's what we've got to get to. So it really means changing the way that we live and on the landscape. And that's in the watershed. But there's no policies that say, oh, we have to think about salmon when we're putting in a housing development, or we have to think about salmon when we're building roads or putting in ditches or putting up a mall. There's no connection between, oh, what you're doing on the landscape is affecting the ability of these fish to survive. That is a total disconnect. So what we often are advocating for is what we call fish first policy. So when you make a decision, a land use decision in a watershed that has salmon, and in coastal British Columbia, that's most of them, that you've got to think about how that footprint of what you're doing is going to affect. There's a fundamental shift that has to occur in how we're showing up on the planet, both in terms of our economic models and our consumption and our choices, and then right down to the choices that we're making just living within a watershed on a daily and weekly basis.
This is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints. Check out our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
To Ontario now, where the Six Nations Wildlife Stewardship Organization discovered rare hummingbirds in the area. During recent fieldwork, the office found that albino ruby-throated hummingbirds were present in the region. Across North America, just over 150 albino hummingbirds have been observed. The fact that Six Nations has multiple birds is very rare, says Lauren Jones, Wildlife Stewardship Management Assistant. It's very interesting they're able to survive in this area, she says. The Six Nations Wildlife Stewardship was also able to study several areas around Six Nations of the Grand River, including the Dunville Marsh, as it just wrapped up their ecological land classification fieldwork days, working to identify plants and wildlife present on the territory. In Oshawa, Ontario, Andrew Dow spoke with Lauren Jones, Wildlife Stewardship Management Assistant for the Six Nations, about the discovery of the albino hummingbirds and the work they're doing on the reserve.
I mean, for me, it's got to be the hummingbirds. I just think that's so cool. Albino anything is super rare in the natural environment. As you could probably imagine, they're pretty easy to pick off, and they're very likely to get predated by things, right? Because they stand out so much. And so when I did a little bit of research on albino honeybirds, there's only been about 150 recognized, like, oh, we found this in all of North America. So the fact that we found multiple on Six Nations is a really big deal. And it's very interesting that, you know, they're able to survive in this area as opposed to somewhere else where they're not found at all. So the albino hummingbirds is definitely a highlight for me. I think that's so interesting, but I'm an animal nerd, so that's probably not surprising either. The other part is just being able to identify things on the reserve that previously in my office, I have no record of them. So you remember I mentioned the biological inventory in 1985, but there were species that we found in these investigations this past year that weren't even mentioned in that original biological inventory. So things like Spring peepers, for example, that we know that they're there. We've heard them, but they were not written down anywhere. So it was kind of cool to be able to like add things to the biological inventory for Six Nations and to kind of get that on record.
Do you plan on focusing on animals as well as plants too?
I would love to. ELC is kind of just a good starting point because there is obviously those indicator species and things that would be like in a deciduous forest versus like a cultural woodland, right? But then if we have specific interests or we have specific concerns about certain animals and certain wildlife, then we'll be able to hopefully pinpoint areas that we can kind of look to do surveys on and to kind of assess in that way. So for example, if I don't know if you're familiar with bobolinks or meadowlarks, anything like that. So they're both species at risk that tend to favor like meadow habitats. So we're not going to find them in the deciduous forest, but we know that they're on Six Nations. I've seen some iNaturalist postings of them. And so if I were to do a project on bobolinks and meadowlarks, I would target survey areas that were more meadowish in nature. And so being able to kind of do these initial assessments allows us to kind of work more effectively for future projects. More input from the community is always lovely. I mean, people that live here obviously know this land much better than I ever could. So if anybody knows of any species that, you know, like if you have like a species at risk on your property and you want to study it, then let me know. And I would love to talk about it. I'd love to see it for myself too. And in general, this is such like a special place. And I want to be able to assess and protect those natural features as much as I can. A lot of the challenges usually come from, you know, just lack of money and lack of time.
Another thing I do know that garnered a lot of attention in the media on the reserve was during the summer, there was the possible cougar sighting. I was just wondering if you had any insights on that or anything you could share that maybe people would find interesting.
Unfortunately, so cougars, they no confirmed sightings within this area. Let's start there. And I do want to make it clear that there's a difference between a wild population and like a released pet. Unfortunately, released pets are kind of a thing that we have to get used to and a thing that we should be expecting a lot more. I know that there's a while ago, for example, there's a released cougar that was caught near Orangeville that was declawed, which is obviously questionable, and it's obviously a released pet because it's declawed. So that being said, like wild cougars, they do tend to like their space. They don't like to be near humans at all. I mean, I'm not saying that it's impossible for a cougar to be on Six Nations. Anything's possible. The best that I can say is, you know, like your health and safety. If you see a big cat and you're concerned for your health and safety, like that takes priority over anything else. Unfortunately, I can't really give a conclusive answer, though.
I think that's interesting as it is, but thank you very much for doing this, Lauren. Best of luck with all the work in the coming months, and I do look forward to seeing some of the findings from that work as well. All right, Lauren, thank you very much for doing this. This was awesome.
Last story today, Hockey Nova Scotia gives a helping hand to human nature as a new initiative aims to eliminate abuse of their officials. Hockey Nova Scotia started distributing in November green armbands to all officials under the age of 18 to indicate that they are a young person learning their craft. Many officials are leaving the sport because of the abuse they receive on and off the ice by parents, players, and coaches. A third of all new officials quit the sport after their first year, and the numbers keep declining after that. Last year, some 900 officials were registered with Hockey Nova Scotia. In Liverpool, Nova Scotia, here's Ed Alderson.
A new initiative by Hockey Nova Scotia aims to eliminate abuse of their officials while keeping more referees involved in the sport. Beginning in November, every minor hockey association across the province received green armbands. The bands will be distributed to all officials under the age of 18 to indicate they are a young person learning their craft. Referee-in-chief for Hockey Nova Scotia, Rick Hill, says studies show the number of officials leaving the sport because of the abuse they receive on and off the ice is alarming.
30% or more of officials quit after the first year, 50% are gone after year two, and over 65% are gone in year three. And the main reason when we talk to these people is it's the abuse from the fans, the parents, the coaches on the ice.
Hill says the hope is people will begin to understand the person making the call on the ice is developing their skills just like the players. The initiative was started in Quebec and has been up and running there and in Eastern Ontario for a couple of years. The Quebec Minor Hockey Associations borrowed the idea from soccer and baseball leagues who were experiencing similar problems with abuse of their officials. Hill says he's been hearing stories of fans working to educate other fans when the green armbands are in place.
We've been told stories where another fan will come up to them and say, "Do you not see the green armband? Do you know what that means?" And a conversation will take place. And now somebody else has been educated on what it is. And it's just something we're hoping is going to twig their personality and the way they act. And maybe they'll just cut back. They'll realize, like, holy cow, what am I doing? You know, this person is new to the job. And here I am treating him as if he's an adult and been officiating for years.
Hockey Nova Scotia is fully embracing the initiative, going as far as to double the suspension for any team or coach found to be abusing an on-ice official. Last year, around 900 officials were registered with Hockey Nova Scotia, and Hill is hoping to see all of them and more return. He says the message that everyone involved with hockey needs to hear is to respect one another.
Green armband or not, remember that the officials out there are trying to do a job. They've stayed in the game, and they're giving back to the game so that hockey players can play the game, because you can't play without officials. So remember that when you look out there, that they're just like the players. They're going to make mistakes. You know, if nobody on the ice made a mistake, we'd have a 0-0 hockey game. So there will be mistakes made, but just curb it down a bit and let them do their job.
He says respecting all officials will ensure games will continue to be played in rinks from one end of Nova Scotia to the other.
Remember that that official out there is somebody's son or somebody's father. And, to heap that any abuse on them, and that it's not something we need in the game, and we need to get rid of it.
I'm Ed Halverson.
That's it for us at Viewpoints. Thanks to our reporters this week, Loni Taylor, John Roon, Andrew Dow, Ed Halverson, and to Maureen McEwen, our national coordinator. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada in Ottawa. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Remember to tune in to all our stories on canada-info.ca. Thanks for being with us. Take care. Stay tuned to the radio show that follows.
Kingston, Ontario. You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.